And so what I thought I would do is just speak for a few minutes about, just share some thoughts about Buddhism and its goodness, particularly in terms of a school, and some of the qualities of Buddhism that I think lend itself to both a school and in the West, and for a diverse group, people who are and are not Buddhists, and for whom the tradition or the religion of Buddhism may be more or less important. You know, in the early years when we were getting started and Buddhism was not very cool yet, oftentimes people would ask, is it a religion? And I would say, if that's helpful to you, that it be a religion, then it certainly is. If it's not helpful to you, if it would be helpful to you, if it's not a religion, then it certainly is not. And that's not being glib. It's, you know, the Buddha never used that term. The term that he used was path. And he was very clear about that. Religion is really a more of a Western concept anyway. And it's also not glib because Buddhism is not based fundamentally on doctrine, although it has teachings. Our relationship to those teachings is very particular in Buddhism. And it's not dogmatic in the sense that by extension of that relationship to those teachings, it's not compulsory in any sense of the word. You can't make somebody meditate, for instance. You can't make someone let go of something they're holding on to. You can't make someone want to live a good life. But we can certainly do things that might influence a person to do those things. And so Buddhism really, understanding that, approaches it from that track, is how can we create conditions that are conducive to cultivating within ourselves and those around us the best life possible. And the Buddha described that in a very succinct way. He said the best life possible is to cease from all harm, do all that is good, and examine your mind. And that in order to cease from harm and do all that is good, in Buddhism, studying the mind is rather important. Because otherwise, we it's hard to know sometimes what is good and what is not. And even when we do know, it's sometimes hard to do it. And so that's where it becomes a path. Another way in which Buddhism is very appropriate, I think, to be in a school or have elements of it in a school. And incidentally, some of the great and earliest universities in Asia and in India were in the Buddhist monasteries, where the fields of study were not just Buddhism, but natural sciences, mathematics, and astronomy, and so on. But another reason I think it's really appropriate is because Buddhism is, at its heart, very much a path of inquiry and examination. So the function of the teachings in Buddhism is to basically, if you think of the Buddha as having been an explorer, somebody who went on a journey and traveled very deep into his inner space, and had this very profound experience we speak of as enlightenment, which brought him to direct understanding, sort of beyond concept, direct understanding of the nature of things, what it is to be a human being, what is the world, what is it, how does it work, how do we interact and relate to each other in a way that we can cease from harm and do all that is good. And then the Buddha spent the rest of his life just, in a sense, reporting. This is what I saw. This is what I experienced. This is what anybody would see and experience if they took that same journey. And so in that way, Buddhism is beyond Buddhism. You know, the Buddha wasn't creating a tradition called Buddhism. He was just teaching. He was teaching a path. And he was interested in teaching anyone who was interested in studying the path, and for whom he thought it would be helpful. There were some people who came to him who wanted to study, and he moved them in other directions. The sense being that they already had a path, or they were already moving in some other direction that would perhaps be more helpful to them. And so everything that Buddhism is, all of the teachings, the practices that have come out of this 2,500 years of tradition, which really means practice, people doing the path, that all of that functions to bring ourselves inward to do that inner exploration in which we encounter the whole world. We begin to realize that that sense of difference between inside and outside is illusory. That sense between self and other is illusory. That sense between private and public, in a certain sense, is illusory. And that all of the teachings, some of which are very simple and easy to understand, some of which are very, very profound and difficult to understand, because they're pointing to such profound things in the world, that all of them are intended to bring us to that inner exploration, which again includes an outer exploration, but of a different kind than we're used to, so that we come to our own experiential sense of what it is to be a human being and how to live. And so the teachings are really designed in all the practice and monasteries and practice centers and robes and incense and sutras and all of that, is really designed to bring us to a point where, in a very real sense, all of that drops away. The Buddha likened it to a raft, that when you come to a great body of water and you want to cross over, you need to build some sort of a structure. And so you build a raft, and it ferries you across, and when you reach the other shore, you don't need the raft anymore. And so in a sense, all of the structure of Buddhism is designed in that way. My teacher said it's all designed to self-destruct, which doesn't mean it doesn't continue to be useful. But it's useful in a different way, because we now understand that there's nothing inherent within it. The Buddha spoke in terms of what is skillful and what is not skillful. In terms of everything. Everything we do, everything we think, everything we say, the choices we make, the directions we move in, are they skillful or not? Which raises the question, skillful towards what purpose? Right? And so an important part of Buddhism is helping us to examine what is the purpose that we want to be skillful towards. And so Buddhism has a great deal to offer in terms of how we might think of that, the questions we might ask about that, so that we can come to our own sense of that, our own determination. And so in that way, this a path of inquiry, of examination, that's why it's not dogmatic, because it's not telling anyone what they should do or think. But it is saying, what we see is that when we move in this direction, that doesn't usually work out so well. When you move in this direction, that usually works out pretty well. And so in that way, it is both guided, and so we do need teachers. We need people who have larger perspectives than we have, right? Like a parent for a child. So when a child, you know, when their life is ended because they can't have a cup of juice, or they can't have, you know, a playtime with their friend, right? Because their perspective is such that it's hard to hold such a thing. But the parent has a larger perspective, right? Because the parent has lived longer and sees things more. They can place that within a larger view and understand that although this is very painful for the child, this is part of how you learn to live in a larger world. This is how you learn to live in a larger world. It's by navigating those moments. And so in Buddhism, there is very much the need for that kind of guidance, that larger view, which is what we look to our teachers for and to the teachings for. But it's always from the understanding, and this is also why I think it's a Buddhist school is a wonderful thing, is because what the Buddha realized is, what he was enlightened to is what we in our tradition call Buddha nature. Buddha means awakened one, somebody who is awakened. So when the Buddha Gautama was enlightened, he became known as Buddha, right? Referring to his awakening. But what he was awakened to is that what liberated him from suffering and confusion, what he experienced within himself, we all have, we all possess. That's what we call Buddha nature, this fundamental nature, which is has nothing to do with what you look like or where you come from or what you do in your life. You can't diminish it. You can't increase it. It's just your nature, like the nature of water is wetness. Right? You can't separate them. And so Buddha nature, which is really a fundamental, sort of the fundamental starting place, if you will, in Buddhism, is that we are originally and in every moment complete, sufficient, perfect in a Buddhist sense, in this sense, in the same way that the ocean is perfectly the ocean. The sky is perfectly the sky, whether it's cloudy or clear. A tree, whether it's a mighty oak or a very small stunted oak, is still perfectly a tree. When we stand back and measure it against another, when we have ideas about it, then we turn it into something else. But to the tree, it's just completely itself. And so starting from or understanding this basic nature as being complete and perfect, what a wonderful, not just what a wonderful idea, but what a profound truth. So that all of Buddhist practice, rather than an attempt to try and correct our mistakes, our mistakenness, or fix our brokenness, or merge our separatedness, which we all experience the sense of, that Buddhism starts from the point of view that all of those senses of mistakenness, brokenness, distance, is part of what we call our false views. They're not true. And so all of Buddhism and Buddhist practice is really trying to help us to see that directly so that then our lives express that. So let me just pause and see, because I don't really know who I'm talking to. We haven't met before. And I have no idea really what your thoughts are, you know, what has brought you to this school, which has brought you to want your children to be here, and what this is for you, and what the mighty yeses might be, what the questions or concerns might be in terms of it being a Buddhist school, being based in Buddhism. So I'd like to just ask and see, are there any questions that we could discuss that might help to address any of those questions or concerns?
Sure. Hmm? Oh, you, please. Okay. Maybe we could just elaborate a little bit about how the actual teachers themselves are not teaching scripture things to the children. It's more of just a sense and a being and holding the Buddha as a container, perhaps.
Mm. You mean within the context of the school?
Yeah.
Well, I think Noah would be the appropriate person to speak about that.
At this point,
do you want to come up here?
I think we're not doing anything devotional, so they're not praying or bowing, but at a certain point we will introduce some of the logic and reason, and some of that is contained in the sutras, like the Heart Sutra, for example, is about emptiness, but it's a scripture. some of the parents encountered it last year during the book club, and it's very beautiful, and it's a story, but it connects to the logic side of things, would you say?
Yeah, there are two, in Buddhism, there are two really essential aspects of the path, which are, because they're essential parts of us, and one is the more conceptual, so our thinking mind, our reasoning mind, our idea-making mind, and how we look at things and understand them, interpret them, infer, and come to conclusions, and how we all know how powerful that is, right? Because that's what we're really trained in our society. And then there's another aspect of our consciousness, which is, which in a sense, in Buddhism, the conceptual part of practice is to help us understand, in a sense, where we are and the principles upon which we are engaging the practice, life, so that we have both have faith in it, but also understand, in a certain sense, what we're doing. You know, we're not just following rules. We're not just do this because somebody said do this. We're not just doing this today because that's what people have done, did yesterday. You know, in a sense, there's a constant discovery of the truth of what Buddhism is teaching within every person who engages it, whether it's through the teachings, the logic, the sort of concepts of Buddhism. And there's a reason why I think those concepts have been of so much interest in the West and in among non-practitioners, you know, and how they're speaking to people in all different kinds of disciplines, in psychology and neuroscience, in all kinds of disciplines, because they're really not about Buddhism. They're about human nature and the way the world works. And so, but the other aspect, which is very powerful and which we are not often as trained in, unless we're very fortunate, is the non-conceptual aspect of our consciousness, which we're in the midst of all the time. It's like love. You know, who would deny the truth of love? But if I ask you to show me love, can you do that? You could express your love for someone or something. You could show me how you love someone, but can you show me the love itself? I don't think so, right? It's not a thing. It doesn't exist as a thing. And yet no one, when you feel it, you know it, right? And so that's, we're in the midst of this non-conceptual aspect of our being and our consciousness all the time, which we create a lot of concepts around, right? But at its heart, it's something else. There's something much deeper. And Buddhism is about really recognizing and developing both of these in ways that are skillful. And so a lot of our conceptual machinations that we live within are actually not so helpful, right? Obsessive thinking, you know, these patterns that arise over and over again in our thoughts and our actions and our behaviors, just having false views, our projections onto other people that are really based in our own history, not so much the other person, it's a form of all oppression and bias. So there's a lot of conceptual thinking that is actually not skillful. And so a lot of Buddhism, really beginning with the Eightfold Path, is about trying to see that and correct that, if you will, clarify that. And then developing the other aspect, which is the more intuitive, you might say, in a sense, the seat of the more creative aspect of our being, and then ultimately bringing those together. And so that's one reason the meditation in traditional Buddhism is so important, because that's one of the most powerful ways in which we begin to cultivate that non-conceptual aspect of our consciousness. But there are lots of ways, other ways to do that. You know, one of the things I was thinking of when we met last week was, you said, we were talking a little bit about our kids' program and what the school is doing here. And one of the things you said was that the point is not to make the children into Buddhists. And that's also something we feel very strongly about at the monastery. And so I was sharing how when we first started, you know, we spent a lot of time out in nature and we would, you know, tell stories and things that basically brought forth good virtues, good qualities, and a lot about how the kids were relating to each other. And then as they began to be interested in things like, what is this? What is an altar? What is sacredness? What does that mean? What is meditation? What does it mean to be still? What does it mean to just listen? Right? What does it mean to walk mindfully? And because this is so intrinsic within our being as human beings, you can basically bring this to anyone at any age without Buddhist language in a way that makes sense and can be, you know, sort of age appropriate, if you will. But that sense of not trying to, you know, Buddhism is not a conversion practice, tradition. In fact, there are sutras in which the Buddha has some very strong things to say about what will happen to you if you try and impose the teachings on someone. It's not pretty. Basically because what he says is you endanger turning someone away from something they might be inclined towards on their own. But because of that approach, you know, you might turn them away. And really just because everyone needs to bring themselves to it. Just like school. I mean, really, in a sense, you know, I think of school as how do you help children want to learn, which is kind of crazy in a way because we're learning creatures, you know? I mean, that's what we do. So it's, in a sense, it's how do we not dampen that natural enthusiasm for learning? And I see Buddhist practice, which is, you know, more for adults, as very much rediscovering that often because for many of us that has been dampened and become so shrouded with so many negative and kind of non-learning experiences. So it's like really learning again how to be a student. In fact, in our tradition, we have a great value on what we call student mind, beginner's mind. You know, in our culture, we put so much value on being experts and having all the answers. In Buddhism, what's given much more value is knowing what are the right questions to be asking, and can you stay in that place of questioning and not rush to the comfort, right, sort of the false comfort of certainty in having the answer.
I'm curious, as a teacher and thinking of us as parents, how you relate to the word discipline or how you think of corrective teachings?
Mm. That's a great question. You know, something I often say, we just had a whole new group of residents come in this week, and so they're just being introduced. They're like, in training, oftentimes the way you learn is just like you get thrown into the water, right? And you learn by doing, which is a very powerful way of learning. Also, we talk about body teaching, where you learn just by being in the midst alongside other people who have been doing it a little bit longer. So it's a very direct way of learning because it's not explanatory. But discipline is one of the things that, you know, is part of really a spiritual life. In fact, Buddhist teachers say that a spiritual life or an awakened life is a disciplined life. And I encounter so frequently in Western students an aversion to that word. In fact, if you look it up, it has there's a lot of punishment in relationship to discipline. And so I say, okay, use a different word, but it needs to kind of mean the same thing, not punishment. I think of it as, in one of my early lives, I was a musician, and I remember I was spending a summer with my family, and I was preparing to go to music school. And so every day I would go down to this hut that we had to practice so I wouldn't bother my family. And my mother at one point said, because she saw me do this day after day, and she said, you're so disciplined. And it was kind of like, you're so good at doing something, like sort of the implication was that you don't really want to do, you know. And I said, Mom, I want to be doing this. This is what I want. And I said, every day I don't want to go down. Like sometimes I don't want to go down and practice. That's the surface feeling. But then I stop and I think, what do I really want? What I really want is to be a musician. That's a much stronger and deeper feeling. And when I connect with that, then I go down and practice. To me, that's discipline, is how do you find the place within yourself that you freely move in the direction that is in the deeper part of you. You know, because we have to learn how to deal with all of the surface stuff which would thwart those efforts. right? And so if we just base our direction or our development on a feeling, I feel like it, I don't feel like it, it's going to be very precarious. It's going to be very mercurial, you know? And so to me, the discipline is how do each of us, having established some sense of path or direction, how do we hold true to that? How do we follow through and realize that, bring that to fulfillment? And so there's discipline, there's commitment. You know, Buddhist practice, there's vow, which is a very strong expressed kind of binding oneself freely to that commitment. An old Japanese master spoke of an inner conversion. You know, and of course there are large commitments and small commitments, but I think how to speak of that, because it has so many punitive connotations, is important. You know, in a way that sounds like something someone would want to do. Oh, I want to do that. And so then how to, I think school has a particular challenge, perhaps. You know, at the monastery, the only way you get there is you decide you want to go there, right? And so, and every moment that you're there, you're choosing freely. You know, school, children need to go to school. We send them to school. And so there is that compulsory element to it. And so how to, in a sense, perhaps, I don't know, move that into the background and bring forward that natural love of just learning and exploration and creativity and community. How do you think of that?
I think community is a big part of it, learning how to be with your peers and what your responsibilities are and how to make harmony is a big part of it.
Yeah.
They are natural learners, and a lot of learning happens at home. Mm. A lot of important learning happens at home. We have a responsibility for certain basics,
right.
And then the community aspects, I think.
You know, one of the things I see, because people who come, by the time people come to the monastery, they're, you know, one of the other monastics, we were looking through the applications for all the folks that were joining. And Hojin, one of the other monastics, says, "Oh my God," she says, "there's somebody here who was born in 2001. You know, we keep seeing these markers. You know, as we get older, we keep seeing these markers. Like, 2001? Is that possible? So that's usually the age at which they come. You know, they're late teens, and then on up. And one of the things that we have seen over the years, and I think more and more, as time goes on and things keep changing, is the challenge of living in community, of being with people in good relationship, in healthy relationship. And living in a religious community is a very particular kind of community, particularly where we train, because we're really together a lot. We wake up together, we meditate together, we work together. It's a very cohesive group. And so, which means, you know, I think of it as skills. You know, people think, oh, I'm in a community because I'm where all these other people are. That's not yet in a community. In community, you know. And that there are really a lot of skills that are necessary to learn about how to be with other people, how to know what's going on inside of oneself and manage, in a sense, when, you know, regulate and just be aware of one's own inner world, and then how to be aware of that in other people, and then how to bring that together. So I hadn't really thought about that before, but in relationship to the school, but I'm just seeing how incredibly important that is. And that even when people want to be in community, they're not always ready. You know, those skills haven't always been fully developed. And so sometimes we have to help them, sort of guide them towards what are those things that they might need to really, you know, do some cultivating of. Yeah.
You talked about some of the parallels between being a spiritual teacher and being a parent, and holding that larger perspective for someone who's stuck in something smaller. Could you talk a little more about that, how you do that as a teacher, seeing one of your students struggle and how that might relate to parenting?
I remember going into my teacher more than once, upset, distraught, confused, you know, in some state of wobble. And, you know, and sometimes rather intense, you know, particularly coming out of meditation and experiencing things that I wasn't, couldn't understand or couldn't really relate to anything familiar in my life. And I would pour this out to him, convey, and he would look at me and go, yeah, not quite bored, but definitely not upset or overly concerned. And that was really great. It was very calming. I mean, bored, I'm being a little facetious. He wasn't bored, but he was certainly nonplussed. And that was very calming because I thought, oh, I don't have to freak out. Like, this is not something that is, like, you have seen this. You know this. And it's not causing you concern, and you have a much larger view, so maybe I don't have to be so concerned. I mean, we are dealing primarily with adults, but one of that sort of the aspects of Buddha nature is that each of us essentially has everything within that we need. Of course, we develop different skills, we grow up differently, we have different experiences, and that creates karma, which, you know, both frees and binds us within in different ways. And that's a lot of what our life is about, is working out and using those particularly powerful karmic streams within us, particularly the ones that are binding, to work certain things out in this lifetime. In a sense, those are the opportunities that we're given. But that the basic understanding is that we all have what is needed, and that, for instance, compassion in Buddhism is not that I cannot save you, right? I cannot experience what you're experiencing. Empathy is when you're in pain and I'm in pain. It's sort of expressing that basic connect, that basic identity of Buddha nature. But I'm not actually experiencing your pain, right? It's mine. But there's a link there. And so in the same vein, I can't take that pain away from you. You have to do that. And compassion is, how can I help? As a friend, as a whatever my role is, whatever our relationship is, whatever the conditions are that I might be able to provide, so that you can do what you have the capability of doing. And so it means I have to be able to hold not just your pain or your discomfort or your confusion, but mine. Because if I care about you, I will have some of that. And so my compassion can become misguided by my trying to help you get over this thing because I can't tolerate this discomfort I'm feeling. So it's not really for you anymore. It's for me. And so the teacher, or, and I'm not a parent, so that this is as far as I go, talking about being a parent. But as a teacher, it's recognizing that this person is on a path. And where I live, they know that, right? Now, they may not be all in. They may have one toe in. But they have brought themselves there. So, you know, a child isn't thinking that way, but they are. And so having the confidence that this person has the materials within them, they're forming, right? And so, and while they're forming and we're not very well practiced, things are a little sloppy, you know? So as we're learning, whenever we're trying something new, it's a little sloppy. So we shouldn't expect perfection. In fact, I would say let's just flush the idea of perfection down the toilet. Right? I think it's a false and dangerous idea, that kind of perfection, you know, not making mistakes. So really coming out of the confidence that this person can hold it. You know, something that really helped me with that was we do a lot of work in the prisons. And I'm doing less of that now directly going in, but for many, many years I was going in a lot to different prisons, and mostly maximum security. So I was working with mostly men who were in for long, long bits and who had done really terrible things in their life. And they were very wise about that. You know, and I would sort of talk about that from my perspective, about how hard it was, and you know, and the many injustices alongside the fact that they committed crimes. And they were very like, you know, this is that every person, they sort of felt every person sort of was able to bear what they experienced, what they were, had created and were given. And so it doesn't always feel that way. You know, we don't always feel like we're up to it. And I think that's where, in the monastery, part of the, what we do is create a structure that helps the person to not be alone in that. And it's kind of an interesting thing that that learning process, or in a sense, you know, ultimately we're all utterly alone. And so how wonderful to go through this life so profoundly alone together. And so that's why I think the community, you know, the Buddha, you know, came to enlightenment under the Bodhi tree and then spent the rest of his life with other people. There was an old Chinese teacher that said, because the Buddha rejected asceticism as part of his journey, and there was an old Chinese teacher that said his great asceticism throughout the whole of his life was that he was never alone. Which is not actually true. The sutras say that he would actually go off into the woods and practice on his own. But and so I think creating, you know, an environment that is sort of that right organic and very dynamic balance of support and structure, enough, but not too much, you know, so that In our tradition, it said that when the teacher talks too much, their eyebrows fall out. Which means, so in Asia, if you have big bushy eyebrows, that's a good thing, right? It means you haven't talked. Because if you talk too much, you're taking away the opportunity for the person to learn for themselves. And so it's how much to provide to just bring the student to the point where they then pick it up and sort of complete that circle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of magic. Well, I hope it's a wonderful year.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful day. Yeah. And you have kindergarten through second now?
We have preschool through third.
Preschool.
Well, we're not really calling them by their grades.
Yeah.
We have three mixed age classes with ages 3 to 9.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am so grateful.
That's
great. To
that was
you
my
for
pleasure.
Coming here.
Thank you very much.
Thank
yeah.
you. And please come back. And
yeah.
also, everyone should really take the opportunity on Sundays to go to the monastery. There's an open sit, and there's instruction and a sermon, and it's lovely. From 9 to noon every Sunday, and then every month there's a children's program. It's on the cmm.org website.
And you can just call us.
Yeah, and we try to put it in our newsletter that we send out, so it's just wonderful. I'm so glad that we're linked.
You know, just one thought, one final thing I thought is that, you know, I mentioned karma, and karma is action, intentional action that has consequence, and that's really everything we experience, everything we perceive is really a result of karma, past actions. And that in the teachings, it's really usually directed towards your actions, your thoughts, your words, and then the consequences of that. And I feel like it's really important to also appreciate that in a way, in a very real way, we can think of a collective or a community karma. You know, that none of us, like, how many of your thoughts actually are just yours, right? In other words, that was their, they had no other outside influence. I mean, and so we're so profoundly immersed in and influenced by everything around us. And so in that way, our responsibility is very much to ourselves, but also very much to each other. And so I think of you as the holders, you know, of in your children, you know, in the educators, and we in our own way, with sort of addressing both that individual and collective karma. And that, like when somebody goes to prison, you know, that's not a sole action. It's not just the action of one person. You know, we have a responsibility. And that sentiment is not particularly strong in our culture right now, right? And from a Buddhist perspective, that's very dangerous to think that way in terms of, you know, an isolated individual, independence. You know, I'm in this on my own. That is, first of all, just patently not true, and it's also very dangerous because it severs all of our natural and really unbreakable bonds that we have to each other. And I think that's why living communities on all these different forms are so important. We have to get better at this. So, thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Thank you. You'll be here.
The next Zen Kids program is on the 15th, and Fukiko and Audrey and Quinn and Meg come. If any of the new parents are interested and want more information, ask one of us.
Yeah.
It's our favorite Sunday of the month.
Yeah, and we're very fortunate to have a very beautiful spot. So we try and have the kids be out as much as possible.
And for any of the kids missing Simon, it's a great opportunity to see Simon.
Indeed. In fact, he's involved now. Yeah.
He'll be one of the leaders.
Right. Yeah. Okay, thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.